That is really something. I am munching on the most incredible piece of Christmas chocolate I've ever had in my life. By the way, just as an aside, I'm Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason. Thank you for joining me. And this is one of those things, I think it comes from Trader Joe's. And it's a glob of chocolate covered in cocoa dust. And when you put it in your mouth, kind of like that, it just disappears in chocolate flavor. Oh, what a great way to start out Christmas week. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Pardon me for that little culinary aside. And there's the chicken. And pardon me for the frog in my throat. I have my annual Christmas cold just coming on. So that's what that little funny noise is in the back of my mouth, but in addition to the chocolate flowing down my throat. Thank you for joining me today here in our last show of before Christmas. And generally what I try to do in that show is to offer some reflection. And I'm often usually in a good mood to do so, a reflection on Christmas, because I had just come, as I did last evening, from the Christmas concert at Grace Community Church. Grace is where John MacArthur is the pastor. And if you were on my Facebook, you noticed that I made a little comment about that and took a quick shot of my family there in the pews waiting for the concert to begin and posted that yesterday. But if you live anywhere in Southern California within striking distance of Studio City, this is where, not quite, San Fernando Valley, let's just put it that way. That's where MacArthur's church is. You ought to make this an annual event, just like my family and I do. We go every year for the evening concert. Usually it's the weekend before Christmas, and it is a highlight. It is unbelievable music. There is a fellow who shows up every single year. And, some of the faces I recognize from year to year, and they have solos, and they have children singing, and they have a bell deal, a bell thing, you know, how they do the clang the bells, and orchestra and choir, unbelievable. But there's a gentleman named Philip Webb, who is a very accomplished opera tenor, and he always sings a couple of numbers, but one of them that is included close to the end is O Holy Night. And I'm telling you, you have never heard O Holy Night sung until you've heard Phil Webb sing it. Because he starts out, and you realize this guy's got a big voice, but he's holding back the first round. And the second round, he just seems to go in the stratosphere. And I got to tell you, I was overwhelmed with emotion listening to this wonderful song sung in this wonderful, powerful way. And, you know, that's the song that you can never sing when you're caroling because you can never hit the high notes, right? Philip Webb can, like no one else can. And so I encourage you to consider that if you live here in Southern California. There's also another show tonight, by the way. The final performance of the concert is tonight. If you show up at 5:45 there, which is right at the end of the show, you can get in without tickets if there's seats available, and they take even standing room only, but I think it'll be worth it if you're in the San Fernando Valley. Grace Community Church. Another thing I appreciate about that event is John MacArthur, who for about 10 minutes gives a little homily that essentially is an explanation of the reason for Christmas, and one of the most crystal clear and compelling presentations of the gospel that I ever hear in any given year. It's marvelous, and he's filled with grace as he's proclaiming the message of grace, and that makes it a wonderful event and a very touching thing and a great way to start Christmas week. By the way, I always think that Christmas is an unusual time of year in a certain way. I think it's curious in that this is a time of the year where, or a season of the year, where millions of people proclaim the virtues of Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, these are people without theological conviction. These are people who are not Christian. These could be even Jewish people. They might be Hindu people. If they live in the West, it would not be unusual for them at this time of the year to be caught up in song, singing festively, consistent with the season, songs that extol the virtues of the Messiah. And they do it in theologically precise and, I think, theologically deep and profound ways. And by the way, they do it with vigor. Hark the herald angels. I mean, they throw themselves into it. And even completely secular environments, they're singing away. And many of you might reflect back on your own office parties this weekend, or maybe coming up in a day or two just before Christmas. And lots of times, they're in the midst of the revelry, there are some Christmas carols, and of course you have your jingle bells and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, White Christmas, but you mixed in almost always are going to be some of the classics, and the classics, the theological classics, are the ones that I'm speaking of. In fact, when I mentioned a few moments ago that they speak in theologically profound ways, this was an observation that I made a number of years ago as a brand new Christian, and I realized I've been singing these songs all my life, and I never listened to the words. Hark, the herald angels sing glory to the newborn King. Peace on earth and mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled. Joyful all you nations rise, join the triumph in the skies. With the angelic hosts proclaim Christ is born in Bethlehem. O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in the dark streets shineth an everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. And the songs go on and on. I mean, I got a million of them here. Profound, deep, great theology, and sung with vigor by people who don't really believe it. They are simply entering in to the season, and I think there's something curious about that. And not only that, I think that there is a dark side to this reflection, because so many of those who sang the praises of the Christ child will actually be standing before that same Christ at judgment. And then the picture will not be pretty, will it? And it won't be joyful. It will be terrifying. And I guess one wonders, at least I do, if when that happens, will there be a moment of ironic reflection by that person? Once their, in a sense, fate, unfortunately, is sealed and their doom is secured, I wonder if that reflection will cause them to think, it was all right there. The words were on my lips. It was all so clear, and I ignored it. And I've got to believe, too, on the other side, that there are those who don't understand who are singing, and there are moments, and maybe for some of you, it was Christmas time and singing those songs and what God did in your life then, where you realize the importance and significance of those words, and they became real to you. And when you stand in the future before that Christ child, now a king, you will be standing before him as his own and not in judgment. In his judgment, that is. Anyway, it's just a thought. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, 754-4150. I wanted to offer you something here that I do every Christmas, and it's something I really wish I wrote, but I didn't. And it was written by Andrew Clavin about, 5 years ago. I stumbled upon it in all places, the LA Times, and I liked it so much I just kept it, read it that year, and have read it every year since then. And also then a short piece by the late Harry Reasoner. And they are profound reflections, I think, on things of this year. As I get older, I've had a harder time getting into what might be called the Christmas spirit. That is that emotional engagement that we have with the season. I mean, I know better now what Christmas is all about, but I have a hard time getting in the spirit of it, emotionally engaging. It's not like when I was a kid, and maybe later I'll tell you a little bit about what that looked like. But things have changed, you know, and when you grow up, some of the glitter is gone. I don't know any other way to put that. But the thing that draws me most into the pathos of the season, that is the emotional significance, the feeling of it, if you will, are watching films that have captured something important about this period of time. And of course, the standouts for me are two. A Christmas Carol, particularly the 1951 version with Alistair Sim, I think I mentioned about that last week, and the second one, It's a Wonderful Life. And I think both of those movies are just about perfect movies as far as I'm concerned. And the only liability to those movies is that we get used to seeing them so much on Christmas time that sometimes we're jaundiced a little bit. We miss what's really there. But Andrew Clavin has written this piece entitled Eternity Is Now, Just Ask Scrooge and George Bailey. And I want to read to you what he's written, and maybe you will see these movies in a little different light. He writes, "To my mind, there are only two truly great Christmas movies. Scrooge, the 1951 adaptation of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, starring Alistair Sim, and Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, starring James Stewart. The first I watch every year. I think A Christmas Carol is one of the greatest pieces of wisdom literature the West has produced, and lover of Dickens though I am, I heretically believe this film version improves the original. It takes the story a little more seriously, adding more humanity to the satire and producing more real emotion. The Capra picture, It's a Wonderful Life, isn't quite as durable for me, but after half a dozen viewings, I can still watch it with pleasure. One thing that's always struck me about these two films is that they're essentially mirror images of each other." And here I think comes what I consider the profound reflection that Clavin has made here in this piece. He writes, "In Scrooge, a man grown rich because of heart-shriveling greed is forced by spirits to view the consequences of his existence. In It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey, a man in financial trouble because of his large-souled generosity, is forced by an angel to view the consequences of his non-existence. What would have happened if he'd never been born? On both sides of the mirror, the results are the same, a revolutionary personal transformation, what the New Testament calls metanoia, which is often translated as repentance, but which means literally a change of mind. After the metanoia, there's a lot of Christmas caroling and happiness and that sort of thing. Thus, movie critics who frequently confuse darkness with depth sometimes belittle these films as sentimental. They're wrong. Watched carefully, the films are disturbingly realistic, because for each protagonist, the change in outlook has absolutely nothing to do with the change in circumstance." By the way, friends, that is such a profound observation, I'm going to read Clavin's statement again. "Watch carefully, the films are disturbingly realistic because for each protagonist, the change in outlook has absolutely nothing to do with the change in circumstance. They aren't singing carols and so forth because they've won the girl or beaten the villain or made millions or righted wrongs. Scrooge can never bring justice to the people he's ruined. And Bailey will never become the world-traveling architect he wanted to be. And yet in the aftermath of their visions, both men are joyous. I don't deserve to be so happy," Scrooge mutters. but I can't help it. And Bailey lets out a heartfelt yay when the angel returns him to the dreary town that has been the graveyard of his ambitions. This hard-nosed realism about the indelibility of sin and failure is precisely the difference between Dickens and Dickensian, between Capra and Capra-esque, between happy endings rich with sentiment and those soggy with sentimentality. It is also, for me, the very best of what faith has to offer. And then he closes with this thought. Scrooge and George Bailey, in traveling through misery to see the eternal born in time, are descendants of those wise men who traveled through the wilderness to see God born into history. To such a vision, amid failure and sin, and even in the face of death, there's one response. Yay! Anyway, that's Eternity Is Now. Just Ask Scrooge and George Bailey, written by Andrew Clavin 5 years ago in the LA Times. One last thing before we go to break and to your calls, and the number here, 1-800-227-5278. Room on the lines here, and if you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Just one quick thing before we break, and this is something from the late Harry Reasoner, and here's what he says. Christmas is such a unique idea that most non-Christians accept it, and I think sometimes envy it. If Christmas is the anniversary of the appearance of the Lord of the universe in the form of a helpless baby, well, it's quite a day. It's a startling idea. The theologians who sometimes love logic more than they love God find it uncomfortable, but if God did do it, he had a tremendous insight. People are afraid of God and standing in his very bright light, but everyone has seen babies and almost everyone likes them. So if God wanted to be loved as well as feared, he moved correctly here. And if he wanted to know people as well as rule them, he moved correctly because a baby growing up learns all there is to know about people. If God wanted to be intimately a part of man, he moved correctly, for the experience of birth and familyhood is our most intimate and precious experience. So it comes beyond logic. It's what a bishop I used to know called a kind of divine insanity. It is either all falsehood, or it is the truest thing in the world. It is the story of great innocence, of God, the baby, God in the power of man. And it is such a dramatic shot toward the heart that if it is not true, for Christians, nothing is true. So even if you did not get your shopping all done, and you are swamped with the commercialism and frenzy, be at peace. And even if you are the deacon having to arrange the extra seating for all the Christmas Christians that you won't see until Easter, be at peace. The story stands. It's all right that so many Christians are touched only once a year by this incomparable story, because some final quiet Christmas morning, the touch will take. Harry Reasoner. And I'm Greg Kokel, and this is Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Stand to Reason. Stand to Reason.
Oh, that sounded like Annabeth there. She is actually in studio with me now. I cannot get her to come on the mic, though. I think they just... Did you just grab a little snippet there in the sound booth? Okay, Greg Kochel, Stand to Reason. And so glad you've joined me today. Let's see. 1-800-227-5278 here in our Sunday before Christmas. I welcome you to call in with anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Let's go to our first caller, and this is a long way away. My first call from Hamburg, Germany. I want to say guten Tag, but that would be good afternoon to me, but I don't know what time of day it is for you in Germany. Welcome to the show, BJ.
Hi, thanks a lot. Yeah, it's midnight here. I guess we're 20 past midnight.
All right. Yeah. Well, it's nice of you to stay up so late to give us a call.
Yeah, I really enjoy your show. I mean, I've also gone through the tactics and everything, and have used that in my church, and it's great.
Do you go to is that a church of expatriates? You sound like an American.
I'm American. Yeah, I've actually married a German, and I've been out here for about 7 years now.
Do you go to church there of expatriates, like other Americans that are living in Germany, or do you go to a church with Germans?
No, those are more in the south. I'm up here. Actually, my church is an international church, and it's an English-speaking church, which consists of about 50 different nationalities.
No kidding, huh?
Yeah,
that's great.
Interesting church there.
Oh, well, what's on your mind today, BJ?
Yeah, you know, I have come across this the birth narrative, this sort of a difficulty, and it's kind of challenging my doctrine of inerrancy, and I'm just trying to develop that.
Mm-hmm.
It's specifically with regard to just the account where they return back to Nazareth,
mm-hmm.
and it seems as if in Luke they return back from Nazareth, I believe, after the purification rites that were performed at the temple with the sacrifice,
mm-hmm.
and in Matthew, they return back to Nazareth after they
go to Egypt.
Left Egypt.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Give me the let me make a. I've got the two passages here. I mean, I'm turning to them, and I've heard kind of these objections before, and I know I've covered them. So, but I can't recall all the details. But let me make a couple of comments just in general about alleged contradictions, and about the issue of inerrancy. The first thing is that it's important to understand when you're dealing with contradictions exactly what a contradiction is. And you also have to understand the nature of ancient writing, okay? So first thing is the nature of a contradiction. A contradiction is the kind of thing where the two things can't be true at the same time. In other words, it's logically impossible for them to be true at the same time. So if I affirmed that I saw Melinda in the studio on this day, and then I affirmed I did not see Melinda in the studio on that day, and I meant the same thing by see and studio in both cases. There's no ambiguity about the words. Well, that would be a contradiction because it seems like they both can't be true at the same time. But if I said I saw Melinda in the studio and I told that to you, and then I said to somebody else I saw Barbara in the studio and I didn't mention Melinda at all, that mm-hmm. wouldn't be a contradiction because there's no inconsistency between the two testimonies. It might be that I saw both of them, and I only told you about one and someone else about the other because that was what was relevant to our conversation, all right?
Okay.
So the reason I'm mentioning this, BJ, is there are a lot of times when people point out alleged contradictions when in fact they weren't meant to be. The accounts aren't contradictory. You see this in the Gadarene demoniac. In one case, it cites one demonized man. In another gospel, it cites two. Well, it doesn't say there was one and only one in one, and the other one doesn't say there was two and only two. It just talks about the demoniacs, but in one case it focuses on the individual. The other one it mentions there was another one too. That's commonly pointed out as a contradiction when, in fact, it isn't at all. It is it's just a bigger picture of the story. So, pardon me. We have the same thing in Genesis 1 and 2 where they think there's a two creation accounts, but it looks like it's very simple to take the second creation account and see it as an expanded version of the sixth, the day of creation. So there's no reason to, and it's uncharitable to call things contradictions when there is a resolution that's available. All right, and there's another thing that so that's the first thing. Not all so-called alleged contradictions even qualify as real contradictions. The second thing that I mentioned is you have to keep in mind the nature of ancient. Like historiography, we have a certain standard of reporting nowadays that wasn't the standard then. So we report things largely in chronological order. And in the past, they reported things in sometimes thematic order to make a point. And so what you're going to find in some Gospels, you're going to see some events that are askew compared to other Gospels, as if one relates one series of events and another one contradicts it, when in fact it wasn't a series of events in time that was meant to be characterized at all by the writers. It was a collection of events that might have happened at some different times, and so one sermon that or parable that is cited might have happened at a different time, but it's collected together into one place for the purposes of theme that the writer has in mind. So okay. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Okay.
So if
more
we
controlled by the theme, more controlled by the theme of the writer rather than just a strict, rigid chronological order.
Exactly, it is exactly right. And so, just because you have a different order there, doesn't mean you've got you have a chronology. You have a contradiction. The authors did not intend to put it in that kind of order so that there is no contradiction that could be raised against it. The contradiction is only apparent because what we're doing is we're taking a 20th century standard and trying to impose it on texts that were not written with those sensibilities. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one other thing that this often happens here is you can have things that are contiguous in time. That is, I shouldn't say not contiguous. I mean that are temporal related, where one thing follows the next. One thing follows the first. The second follows the first in the text, but there could be a big hole in time between the two things.
Okay.
So you could say Jesus such and said such and so, and then he said such and so. Well, right there between those two verses, it might be a week of time or a month of time has passed. The writers aren't concerned with trying to record all the information. They're trying to bring the teachings together, and that's what's relevant to them. Okay.
Okay.
Now I am not looking at the text right now, and maybe you can guide me to the Luke passage or the Matthew passage. Sends Joseph and Jesus and Mary to Egypt, right?
Right. That one would be Matthew 2:22.
Okay. Let me just look at this. They rose and took the child and his mother and came to the land of Israel. And when they heard that Archelaus was reigning over, Joseph had a dream, warned by God, and off they went to. He departed for the regions of Galilee. And then, I see. The Matthew passage has him going to Galilee, and the Luke passage has him going to Egypt. Is that right?
The other way around.
Because I'm reading here.
Matthew
20. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's Matthew 20. Matthew 22 is when they return from Egypt. I guess, or from 19 to, 23, I guess, that paragraph.
Oh, yeah, I see it. And then he goes back. Okay. Then the Luke passage, mm-hmm. I've got it. Matthew, Mark, Luke, then. And Luke.
Luke 2:39 is when the one that says they returned from Nazareth.
All right.
They returned to Nazareth.
And when they, at the very moment she came, began giving thanks to God. And when they performed everything according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee to their own city of Nazareth. And the child grew and became strong. Right. Okay, this, I think, is exactly the circumstance that I was describing before.
Mm-hmm.
We are given a certain sequence of events by the writer Luke. Okay, and that is, and what he's saying is that the return to Nazareth came after the temple work was done. When we read it, it sounds like it happened the next day, because he's just patching these things together. But you'll notice there are other passages, and I can't bring them to mind right now, but where we have something similar like that, and one actually that comes to mind was Jesus cursing one of the trees, and it immediately withered, and it sounds like it withered later the next day in one case, whatever. But what I think what's going on here is you've got Luke just citing the next relevant thing as far as he's concerned. He doesn't care about the Egypt trip. What he cares about is Nazareth and the Galilee and that whole part of Jesus' ministry, and Jesus moving on. And in fact, the next verse or so in Luke says, okay, then he grew up, and then he began preaching, he started his ministry, and so you can see how Luke is jumping ahead there. We have more detail in Matthew as to what happened, though, between the temple visit and the return to Nazareth. What we have is a side trip for 2 years or so to Egypt. So the way I look at this is that Matthew is just giving us more information that Luke was not interested in giving us. And again, I think this is consistent with the intentions of these writers. And in fact, if you think even yourself, when you tell stories about things that happen, you took a vacation, And so I was thinking last summer when the first day out on our vacation fishing in northern Wisconsin, I took Annabeth in the boat and she got a bug in her eye. And so I might have characterized it, she got a bug in her eye, and then we had to take her to the doctor's office.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't take her to the doctor's office until the next day. But if I would have told you she got a bug in her eye, and then we went to the emergency room or to the doc,
right.
Whatever. And then, now, it would sound like I just went directly there, but that isn't what I mean. I mean that these are the sequence of events, but there was a time gap in between.
Right, right.
So
either way would be an accurate description of what happened.
Exactly. Now, now you might say, yeah, well, you got a time gap of maybe 10 hours, right, but not 2 years. I said, that's right, because I'm not explaining the course of her young life. I'm just explaining what happened that day. But if I were to talk to you about my life, I might say, well, I spent 4 years in Wisconsin in the early 50s, and then our place burned down, our house burned down in 1955. And that happened. I said, and then we moved to Chicago. And then I end up going to high school in York High School in Elmhurst, Well, the fact is we didn't move in right away when the farm burned down. We moved into the shed, for the garage for 3 or 4 months. And then we moved to Chicago, and I went to high school 18 years later or 10 years later, whatever it is. Notice how I'm giving the larger picture, and I'm just jumping past a whole bunch of details that I don't care to tell you about.
Yeah, right.
So what I'm trying to describe here, BJ, is I'm just trying to describe that this is the way not only ancient people wrote accounts, but it's kind of the way we do things today. And it can be confusing when we read these accounts initially because we're not looking for a jump in time, but sometimes we go to other gospels and we find information that fills in the gaps. And if we are writing the full story, we include all of those things. And that's not an unusual way to write or to record those events. That's basically what I'm saying here. It's not a contradiction. It is possible to see these things fitting together. Does that make sense to you, BJ?
Yeah. I mean, the way you just explained it to me, would you also do the same thing, like when you'd be explaining it to a non-Christian, like this idea of the doctrine of inerrancy?
Well, I actually wouldn't get into the discussion of inerrancy with the non-Christian because that's really an in-house debate, and I don't really need an inerrant Bible in order to make my case for the truthfulness of Christianity. I believe in inerrancy, but I don't need that. I think what I need is an historically reliable Gospels. That is, that the salient details of the Gospels, that specifically the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, that those things are largely true. And even if we can quibble about smaller points, like, well, did Jesus go to Egypt or not, that's not, from a historical perspective and theological perspective, it's not relevant. Somebody might want to bash us, for example, about inerrancy and beat us up on that because they don't like this gap or this the way these read. But it doesn't change that Jesus claimed to be God and claimed to be the Messiah of the world and then died on a cross and rose from the dead, if the evidence actually demonstrates that that's the case. What I don't want to do with others is I don't want to strain at a gnat and swallow the camel. I don't want to fuss about little details that they may not agree with me on and miss the larger point. If Jesus did rise from the dead, that's where that's the historical information that really matters the most. But I do think we have a reasonable answer for this challenge. And what I usually would do with a non-Christian, my tactical approach, would be to start with an illustration. And I might ask them to tell me, where did they go to high school? Or, you know, I want them to give me some narrative. Or maybe I'd give them an example like I did with you. And I want to say, see, it's not unusual for us to skip events and tell things in a certain kind of logical order, even though that there's time that's missed. That's not unusual. And if we said to somebody else something about the details that we're missing, it wouldn't be charitable or fair to call it a contradiction. It's just that there was different purposes. So I'm going to want them to see that this is the kind of thing we even do in conversation. So we shouldn't be surprised to see ancient writers do it as well.
Right.
And so now if Luke said he never went to Egypt, and Matthew said he went to Egypt, now that would be sound like a pretty straightforward contradiction, but that isn't what happens. We just get the series of events, and Luke is collapsing these events to, I think, focus on what he wants to focus on. Notice, by the way, let's see. They began to giving thanks. And verse 39, everything. And they returned to Galilee, to their own city of Nazareth. And the child continued to grow and become strong, increasing in wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. And his parents used to go to Jerusalem every year at the feast of Passover. And when he became 12, they went up there according to the custom of the feast. Notice, now that does report his age there, but you notice how he jumps 12 years?
Yeah,
because he's not interested in that other stuff. It's not important to the details of what he wants to get to. Make sense?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I'm glad that my problem fell right there too. That it just that jump there seems really.
One last thought, BJ, and I'll let you go. I'll let you go to bed there in Hamburg, Germany. And that is that the early Christians had these accounts. Both Matthew and Luke, in the first, you know, within 30 or 40 years, clearly they had these accounts. This didn't trouble them. And the reason it didn't trouble them is because they didn't see it as a contradiction. It's kind of like the two genealogies in Matthew and Luke, you know, one, the genealogies don't match. Well, we didn't discover this 2,000 years later, like nobody saw this before. Everybody saw this and they understood what it was. One was the genealogy through Joseph, and the other one was genealogy through Mary. And in fact, when you look closely at the genealogies, you can see that that's the case.
Yeah.
So I think we have to give credit to the early readers that they weren't idiots, that they could see these things and it didn't trouble them because they realized that in the context of historical writing at the time, they understood what was going on here, and it wasn't a contradiction. And it's only through kind of imposed categories that we use 20 centuries later that make it look questionable when, in fact, it's not a contradiction at all. All right, BJ?
Hey, thank you very much, Greg.
Okay, auf Wiedersehen, and I don't know how to say Merry Christmas in German. You probably do, though.
Frohe Weihnachten.
Okay, I'll take that. Thanks so much, BJ.
Okay.
All the best. All right, that from Hamburg, Germany, and your call coming up next here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker. Issues right out of the headlines. Issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. That music brought to you by Andy Williams. Nice to hear him. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. And our Sunday before Christmas. By the way, I just took a shot, a window shot there, of the Enforcer and Barbara and my little daughter who's running around back there in the control room. And so I'm going to post this on my Facebook next break. So you'll see the view from my seat, all right? We'll do that. So those of you who are involved in our Facebook, my Facebook, you'll get a shot here coming up in another 15 or 20 minutes. And if you're not involved in the Facebook, you can kind of search me out as they do, and you can request to be my friend. Be glad to include you in the family. All right. Let's go back to the phones. And in Raleigh, North Carolina, thank you for calling, Patrick. Merry Christmas to you.
Hello, Mr. Kokel. It's good to hear from you.
Thank you.
I've been a great fan of yours for a long time. And I've actually been wanting to ask you this question for some time.
Mm-hmm.
It's really been bothering me for several years now when I read through the scriptures and I see different areas in the Bible where it looks like it says that God is causing people to sin.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically Pharaoh. I know there's an instance with Saul. Mm-hmm. And then also in Romans 9, that passage particularly bothers me a lot. And I wanted to ask, how is it possible for a holy God to cause someone to sin,
or yeah,
in essence, cause a sin? And then if so, then I guess I would like to ask, like Paul does, you know, why does he then find fault with humans and still condemn us?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And the kind of principle here is biblical interpretation principle is to interpret the unclear in light of the clear. The problem with that principle is that a lot of times it's hard to tell which one's the clear and which one's the unclear. That is, which is the prevailing teaching.
Right.
So I'm going to give you a verse. Pardon me. I should get a drink of water here. I'm having trouble with my throat. There, pardon me. Much better. And the verse is in the Epistle of James, first chapter. You might know of this passage because James talks about this very issue in very, very clear terms. Here's what he says. Verse 13, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For
right.
God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. Now, let me stop for just a moment and clarify what I think he means here, because the word tempt could mean to test. And sometimes
right.
the Greek word is translated tempt, and God's tempting us. And what they mean, he's testing us. He's measuring our mettle, as it were.
Right.
That is one sense of God testing us. We see that in verse 3 of James chapter 1, knowing that the testing of your faith, the refining of it, produces endurance. But in this
right.
passage, he is talking about inducing to sin. So the devil tempts us, and that is an inducement to sin. It's an attempt to push us forward into sin. And James is saying God never does that. For he cannot himself be induced by that evil desire. God cannot be tempted by evil. And he himself does not tempt, that is, induce anyone to sin. But, and then he goes on to explain exactly what the breakdown is. He said, each one is tempted when he's carried away by an enticed, there's that inducement, enticed by his own lust. It's something inside of man. And then when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. Sin is accomplished. It brings forth death. And he goes on then to say, don't be deceived, brethren. Every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. Now, I think the point he's making here, and this is James chapter 1, verses 13 through 17, is he's specifically addressing this charge in explicit terms, and he is saying God cannot be tempted, and the reason he cannot be tempted, he doesn't say this here, we know this from other places, because God's character is holy. That means there is nothing in him to which sin appeals to create an inducement. There's nothing there to work with, as it were.
Right.
But the temptation comes from us, and we have something to work with, and that's our fallen nature. And then he goes on to extol the virtues of God when he's saying that, no, by contrast, every good and perfect gift comes down from above, the Father of lights, and there is no shifting shadow, there's no variation. And I think the point there is that God is holy. He's underscoring that God is holy, and he doesn't deviate from goodness such that he would be subject to such a charge that he is tempting, inducing people to sin. Okay?
Well, that's most definitely the answer that I wanted to hear.
Okay. Now, what we have to do. I'm sorry, I jumped in.
That's okay. I still am confused about, you know, Romans 9 and these other passages.
Absolutely.
You know, how do we explain them now?
No, absolutely. And I wasn't taking the easy way out by just citing the verse and going to move on. Again, I'm trying to use this principle. Let's try to start with the clear and then move to the unclear. So when here we have this passage in which James seems to argue almost pedantically, very clearly and forcefully, that God, nothing like that could be true of God because of his nature. And then we have the Bible is thick with references to his holiness, which is
right.
The virtue of God that James is trading on in making this distinction. So I'm going to argue that the clear and the abundant testimony of the Scripture is to God's holiness, all right? So now
right.
What do we do with the individual passages that seem to suggest otherwise? Well, what we try to do is we find a way to harmonize those things with the goodness of God and see if maybe there's another way of understanding those verses that doesn't create a problem. So let me talk about Pharaoh very quickly, and then we'll take a look at your passage in Romans. I haven't looked at the passage in this light, so this will be a new take to me, but we'll see how it works out. I have looked at the passage in Exodus that deals with the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, which is discussed in the Romans passage. And is that in the passage that you wanted to go to in Romans?
Romans chapter 9, that's right.
Okay, let me go to that. And let me tell you a little bit about just my independent reading of Exodus on this situation, because it is troublesome when you see God hardening Pharaoh's heart. It almost looks like God is causing Pharaoh to sin. And I don't think that's what's going on there. And let me explain what I think is happening. And I can't go verse by verse through this, but if you go through the Exodus account, you're going to see this. Moses first talks to God. God says, Moses, go tell Pharaoh to let my people go. And then God says, Pharaoh will not listen to you. So what is Pharaoh's natural inclination? His natural inclination is to rebel. And in fact, that's exactly what happens. And he rebels, and he rebels, and he rebels, and he rebels. And so he incurs God's wrath in that rebellion, which comes from him naturally, as it were. And then all of a sudden you see the language change, and you see where it says God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Now, I think this is what – here's what I think happens, and then you see it back and forth through the occasion, through the rest of Exodus. So it seems to be a mixture. I think this is what's going on. God has an intention to glorify himself through this whole event of rescuing the Jews, and one of the ways he's going to glorify himself is by bringing the 10 plagues on and demonstrate his power and also bring judgment upon on Egypt. And in demonstrating his power, many are going to believe in him. This is all in the text, okay?
Right.
And because at the end of these events, it says when they saw his power and they saw what signs, then many believed Moses and believed the Lord and followed him, and Egyptians as well.
So
you got this rebellious Pharaoh, right? And what happens with Pharaoh? He does exactly what God predicts he would do, because that's his nature, to rebel. At some point, though, fourth or fifth plague, you know, he starts change. You know, he starts having second thoughts about this whole thing, and
right.
God is not finished with his display of his own power. So he is already, he's earned God's wrath and condemnation.
Right.
But God is not going to deliver it directly yet. He wants to finish his course. And so then he hardens Pharaoh's heart, so Pharaoh continues in the same manner that he was in before. Now, I can see how this would be troublesome to some people, but the way I want to characterize this is God doesn't do something to Pharaoh that he was not already inclined to do and, in fact, hadn't already been doing. All God does is secure the full course of the events that God wants to secure. He didn't take a good man and make him bad. He just took this bad man, who he's going to bring judgment against him, and let him keep rebelling, and so that the full course of judgment could be laid out and the full glory of God could be demonstrated. And that was my results from the independent just look at Exodus. Now, the Romans passage is Romans 9.
Romans 9, and then mostly the whole chapter talks about it, except for the very first paragraph. But then especially when he talks about God creating vessels for honor and dishonor, and, you know, who are you to reply against God?
Right. I think that particular passage or that verse has to do with God knowing in advance that there are many people who would never respond to him.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that I've often been asked is, why is it that God creates people he knows will not believe in him and turn to him for redemption? And the answer is that God uses or displays his glory even in the act of judgment against those who are rebelling against him. So those he makes, knowing they will continue in their rebellion, and the ultimate end will be their wrath and indignation and, you know, their judgment. And so, in a sense, these vessels are made for wrath in that sense, not because God predestined them to wrath, but because that was going to be their certain end in light of their own actions. God knew before he created them that they would be vessels of wrath, and others were vessels of righteousness in his mercy and grace.
Right.
So, that's the way I understand that passage, and I don't think that's stretching things at all there. I think that there are some people, God hardens their heart, but I think if we're using Pharaoh as an example there, God is not causing anyone to do something that they didn't already do or they weren't already inclined to do.
Right.
All he might do is allow that rebellion to continue longer so God's purposes can be fulfilled. And in my view, that doesn't compromise his goodness.
Right.
Does that make sense the way I explained it to you?
That makes wonderful sense, especially the way you talked about the Romans passage. I've heard so many people saying that, you know, even talking about Judas Iscariot, saying that God created Judas Iscariot, not only knowing what he would do, but he created him and compelled him to do what he did.
Yeah, and that's right. And I think there's a real dark space. When I mean dark space, I mean unknown. You can follow out for a while, seeing God working and kind of make sense of his working, and then you've got this kind of a dark matter, if you will, and the dark matter is these mysterious workings where you have Judas making his own choices, but making that are genuinely his. and right. making choices in a way that works perfectly with the foreordained pattern of God to use all of those things for his ultimate glory and the outworking of his plan. And the machinery of that is the dark matter. How does that work together? I don't know. But I think that we are on safe ground, Patrick, in trusting the bulk of the scriptures in what they say about God being holy and good, and then understanding these other ones on a case-by-case basis, as he describes allowing man to be the kind of evil being he is. Okay, good. Hour number two just ahead of us. Thank you for the call, Patrick, and I'll be talking with you in just a moment. Stay with us on Stand to Reason. Ducks and monkeys sound a lot alike, don't they? I agree with that. All right, hour number two here on Stand to Reason. This would be our Christmas weekend. 1-800-227-5278 is my number in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Room on the lines. I've got a couple calls up here to Jesus Celebrate Hanukkah. I'll get to that in a moment. Another call on the deity of Christ and the Trinity. And room for you, though. Love to talk with you here. I hinted at the last beginning of last hour that I might say something about my own childhood remembrances of Christmas, and I also said that the glitter seems to go, as at least for me, as I've grown up, there was a certain magical quality about a Christmas when I was a kid. And I think the significance that Christmas had for me, it's probably fair to say that the significance Christmas had for me as a child was not because of Jesus. He was kind of in the background. We were not believers. We were religious after a shallow fashion back then, but we were not Christians. And we were involved in Christian religion, but not knowing the Lord, and many of you understand what I mean, and because you had a similar kind of experience, and it wasn't until I kind of left everything Christian and then kind of got my head screwed on straight and came back as a young adult that I understood the significance, the real meaning, if you will, of Christmas. But for me at that time, I think the nearly 20 Christmases that I spent, the first 20 years of my life, it was the dozen or so people that I spent those days with that deeply defined what the Christmas spirit was for me. And in this sense, I'm not thinking of Christmas, or I'm not speaking of Christmas in a theological way, but in an emotional way. This is what it felt like. This is what made Christmas feel a certain way. In a way, it doesn't really feel anymore. The beautiful thing for me about Christmas growing up was that it was always the same, or it always seemed to be the same. It was a still point in kind of a shifting and changing world. You could always count on Christmas to be a certain way. You knew what to expect. And I think it was the sameness and consistency of that holiday that created a deep sense of safety for me and a delicious sense of anticipation. This is the significance of traditions, those things that families do year after year that define this time not only for themselves but especially for their children. And that's what happened to me. And as the years passed, the sequence became almost magical. My grandpa, my mother's father, we called Papa. And my dad was an orphan, and so those grandparents weren't in the picture. But my grandfather, Papa, and grandmother, Nani, we called her, would always arrive early Christmas Eve, and with mom and dad and five kids and the ragtag assembly of visitors and relatives and friends, and as we grew older then, sweethearts, the house was a bit chaotic, but it was a pleasant kind of chaos. My mom was very clever with the decorations, kind of a homespun warmth about the house mixed with the scent of pine cones. You know, they burn those little things. That makes the house smell like the forest. And the presents on Christmas Eve were strewn in disarray on the floor beneath the tree. There were drinks, of course, hot cocoa, eggnog, lots of tasty things to nibble. My dad used to put cheese on the end of toothpicks and then push all his toothpicks into a grapefruit. So you had what looked like a porcupine or something, you know. And, of course, the kids jumped on those. There was olives on those toothpicks, too. Christmas Eve meant Christmas carols, a few of them. And, you know, my dad had a great baritone. My mom would sing harmony. The kids, they would sing off-key. I guess that's what we could count on there. And even though I know better now, nothing seemed really planned. It just kind of magically happened then. And then, of course, Christmas morning. And there was another ritual we repeated every single year. All nine of us, that would be the five kids, mom and dad, that's seven, and Nani and Papa. We would station ourselves in a kind of semicircle around the mountain of gifts that seemed to have erupted during the enchanted twilight between barely falling asleep and waking up. Papa, my grandfather, played kind of Santa, creaking around the tree like an old squirrel rummaging for nuts and grabbing the packages and picking them up and, you know, examining it carefully, grunting his ho-ho-hos, extending his arms and squinting through his glasses to announce who the fortunate recipient was. And then, of course, he'd deposit the bundle in the arms of the lucky person. Now, we were not financially well off as a family. In fact, I think we were probably pretty poor from what I know today. But somehow, as dawn gave way to morning, the pile of booty at our feet grew. I don't know where it came from. How my folks afforded it, in other words. Now, the way we did things in the Kokel household is no one was allowed to open anything until Papa had whittled the mountain down box by box. And everybody had their little pile of a booty in front of them. And then we'd open one present apiece in turn, sharing our discoveries with each other, going round and round in the circle, one after another, until the last gift was gone. I mean, it seemed to take all day, and sometimes it did, but it was wonderful. That's what the Christmas spirit, I guess, was for me. I know it won't be quite the same in the future. I'm hoping that it will be like that for my kids. One element added, and that is the wonder of the real meaning of Christmas. And I think that's what's happening. Abby knows that Christmas is Jesus' birthday, and that's the most important part of the season for her, and that's really great to see. And she parades around the house with a little doll under her shirt as Mary Kokel on her way to Bethlehem with baby Jesus Kokel in her tummy. So I think she's got it figured out. 1-800-227-5278. Let's go to Santa Ana and Chuck. Hello, Chuck.
Hello. Let me put you on the regular.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm here.
Hold on. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Off speakerphone. Yeah.
There you go.
John 10:22. I think.
John
10:22. Jesus went into the temple and it was winter and it was a feast of dedication.
Yeah.
Is that something to do with Hanukkah?
Well, I'm not the right person to ask about the Feast of Dedications. I don't think that's what Hanukkah is. Hanukkah is the Feast of Lights, and yeah. In Jewish tradition, it is a celebration of a victory that that the Jews had over the Greeks about 200 years or so before the time of Christ, right?
Right. Yep. but dedication has nothing to do with Hanukkah, huh?
No, I don't think it does. Hmm. And I don't even know if Hanukkah was celebrated during the time of Christ. There might be somebody who's listening who is Jewish or knows more about Jewish traditions. But keep in mind, by the way, Hanukkah was not a celebration that was a legal requirement by the Jews. Most of the other celebrations are things that were God built into the law, Passover, for example, and booths and other things like that. But Hanukkah wasn't that. That was kind of more of a culturally established.
Doesn't sound like a law. Sounds like a celebration of something.
It was a cultural tradition, and it had spiritual significance to the Jews, but it was something that they decided to do. It wasn't written in the law as obligatory for observant Jews.
It was like in between the Testaments, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
You don't think he celebrated, huh?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't. Again, somebody else might be able to tell me when Hanukkah really got to be celebrated more. But by the way, it never had the significance that Christmas has for Christians.
Yeah.
It has grown, I think, in significance because of Christmas for Christians, and so this has been kind of picked up, and the Jews have their holiday right around the same time.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have the same weight, I think, in the Jewish calendar as the other observances that they have.
Okay, well,
so I mean, whether or not Jesus celebrated it, you know, it's an open question.
One last thing: were you ever a pastor of a Eastside Christian Church in Fullerton or somewhere?
No, I was an associate pastor at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach.
Okay, I was thinking that I heard your name before.
Yeah, well, you could have, but not. I mean, I might have spoken out to that church, but
okay, great.
15 years ago, I was. Thank you for the call, there, Chuck. Okay. 15 years ago, I was an associate pastor. I should say. 15 years ago, I stopped being associate pastor and started working with Stand to Reason. Before that, I was, 6 or 7 or 8 years with Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. Okay, thanks for that call on Jesus and Hanukkah. It's an open question to me. Maybe somebody else knows more about that. Let's go to Laguna Beach. Let me find the button here. David, welcome to Stand to Reason, and Merry Christmas to you.
Hey, Greg, thanks. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question about the deity of Jesus, and just kind of wanted to know your thoughts. I came across a conversation with some guy who, it was an interesting conversation because he was claiming Jesus's deity is kind of, it's derivative of the Father, and in himself he doesn't have deity, I guess. But he still holds to the idea that Jesus was begotten and was not made, but at some point he did come into existence.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain.
Well, you can't be begotten and not made and come into existence at some point.
Right. I know. His point was more like, because, you know, I forget what it was, maybe the Nicene Creed, but they say begotten, not made.
Yes, and that's meant to make that. The reason that the Nicene Creed was so important is because the Apostles' Creed was general enough that heretics could affirm it.
Okay.
And the heretical view that was dealt with in the 4th century was the Arian view, that Jesus, there was a time, as Arius put it, there was a time when the Word was not.
Okay.
The Word talked about in John chapter 1, who became flesh. The Word was a created being and therefore He was a second order of importance as the Father.
Subordinate kind of.
Subordinate, thank you. That's what I was looking for. He was a subordinate being to the Father. So Father was the eternal God, but the Word was a created being who took on flesh at the incarnation.
Okay.
And this is not consistent with the testimony of Scripture, nor is it consistent with the convictions of the earliest Christians who always worshipped Jesus as God, even though they didn't work out all the details. So the wording then you see in Nicaea, they try to hammer out some of these details, and they were saying, yeah, he's begotten because the Scripture says he's the only begotten, the monogenes, but he wasn't made.
Right.
And I think the way they characterize that is that the Son, or the second person of the Trinity, was eternally proceeding from the Father.
Okay.
Now, there's some debate among Christians about whether the Word that became flesh in Jesus was eternal, but whether the Word was always the Son.
Yeah.
And so is the Son eternal, or was the Son a a derivative relationship that happened at the incarnation. And, I mean, some people have strong opinions about this, but it seems to me it can go either way inside of Orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
If the Father is eternally the Father, then it seems like he'd eternally have to have a son.
Right.
And so there's discussion about that. But the most important thing is that there is a that the divine nature is no different in the Father than in the Son, and the way that the Father is distinguished, the Son is distinguished from the Father, other than by the work the Son does. I mean, the economic Trinity, we can look at the details of, well, if the Son does these things and the Father does these things, so we see a distinction there. But there's also a distinction in person in that the Son proceeds from the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So this is an important distinction that is made trying to individuate the persons of the Trinity and still maintain the essence which is divine.
Mm-hmm.
So what is different about the Son than the Father? Well, the Son does different things, and he proceeds from the Father. So this is what distinguishes the Son from the Father. But those who wrote the creeds there at Nicaea were careful to point out that that doesn't mean that he ever was made,
okay. But
rather he was eternally proceeding from the Father. And C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity talks a little bit about this, and you might want to look at that very handy little book.
Yeah,
because he uses an illustration that is helpful. He says, picture a book sitting on a table. And you can see how that the table is supporting the book. So there's a certain kind of dependency relationship between the book and the table, right?
Yeah.
Now, normally, we'd say the book is resting on the table. The table is holding the book up. So there's a dependency relationship. Normally we think of books and tables as if we got a table first and then we put the book on the table. And so the table was there before the book. But Lewis says, just imagine that relationship, the book on the table, and then just simply imagine that it's never been any different. That eternally the book has been there on the table. If that were the case, then it would be eternally the case that the book was dependent upon the table to hold it up, but the book was no younger than the table. They both lived eternally, or
right,
existed eternally. He said that might be helpful for you to understand how the Son could be proceeding from the Father, but not having been made, that procession was eternal.
That actually is pretty, that is helpful to understand, because I always, when you start talking about eternity and but you can only describe it, you know, with language depicting time.
Right.
So it's kind of difficult for me to understand.
It is.
The Son proceeds from the Father automatically. For us, at least, it reads into some sort of time.
Yeah, well, it suggests a beginning to the Son,
right.
And that's what begotten suggests, and this is why when the writers of the Council of Nicaea used the language, they were trying to acknowledge the eternal begottenness of the Son, but at the same time affirm that he was never created, but he was, in fact, the uncreated creator,
right,
which not only Colossians mentions, but John mentions in John chapter 1, verse 3, without equivocation. In other words, he says it in a way, there's no way to misunderstand that. So I actually think your friend is mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it might be that, I mean, if understanding what you told me about your friend's idea, I guess I'd have to say that that idea is heretical, okay?
Yeah.
Now, it may be a material heresy, not a formal heresy. And what I mean is some people kind of accidentally and in ignorance think in heretical terms, but they don't realize it's a problem.
Yeah.
But a person who realizes what this means and still holds to, no, I really believe that Jesus was a created being,
right,
well, the church fathers would anathematize that,
right,
that person. So there you have it. Does
okay,
that help?
Well, thank you very much.
Hey,
have a great holiday.
Thank you. Same to you, David. All the best to you. Greg Kokel, the show is Stand to Reason. I'll be back in just a moment.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Greg Kokel here, back with you. Stand to Reason is the show, and I'm giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday from 3 until 6. Let's move quickly here to our next caller, and that would be Jared. Jared, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Well, thank you, Greg. I'm a first-time caller, but a long-time listener.
Well, I'm glad you called, Jared.
And happy Christmas.
Thanks, you.
And
I actually like that way of putting it, by the way, and I haven't heard that yet this year. By the way, now that you mention that, pardon me for coughing, though, I'm fighting off a cold.
Sure.
But now that you mention happy Christmas, I remember the last couple of Christmases using that phrase on purpose because I didn't want Merry Christmas to sound trite. Did you remember me talking about that in past Christmases?
You know, now that you mention it, I do, but I
that isn't why you said that
on purpose.
Okay, well, thank you for reminding me of my habit from the past.
But I have been listening at least that long.
Okay, good, because now I'll start saying happy Christmas. Thank you very much.
Not a problem. My bigger question was about legislating morality and why we would draw a line one place and not another, but then two practical applications, one from my neck of the woods and one out in yours. 2 years ago in Nebraska, we voted down legislation to allow casinos in Nebraska, and I was one of the votes against. And I wasn't really sure why I was voting against it, other than I've heard all the statistics about that bankruptcy and all these different things, alcoholism and all these different rates go up when casinos enter into an area.
And were you convinced that there was a genuine causal relationship there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so
there was.
This is what's called a causal slippery slope in ethical reasoning, and that is where it may not be the case that gambling itself is immoral. But if it turns out that gambling causes other things that are immoral, then the moral quality of these other things kind of slips into this thing that causes it, and it would be legitimate then to inveigh against that activity that causes these other immoral things.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're convinced that there is a connection there, then you've cast a legitimate vote to try to limit the harm to society by using this legislation. In other words, you're using legislation for the common good, which is exactly what legislation is intended to do.
Okay, okay. Because my dilemma there was, now I was thinking about how it applies to, say, bars and things like that, and that both alcohol and gambling can be enjoyable in moderation, but taken to abuse and addiction, then it has very negative effects on society. So if I am against gambling for those reasons, then why wouldn't I be trying to turn, say, my county into a dry county?
Well, it's a fair question. Part of what you have to ask yourself is the ultimate consequence. In the gambling case, you don't say you don't have gambling there, and not starting gambling is preventing gambling from starting doesn't create any problems, and if you allow it to start, it could create all these other problems, and so let's just not allow it to start because of that.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you have drinking establishments, and you have to ask, you know, what is the consequence of those drinking establishments in terms of harm, and how great is the harm? You have to always weigh the amount of good you think the legislation or exercise of power is going to do against the loss of liberty that always results in passing legislation. Sometimes the loss of liberty is too big a price to pay for the good that you think you're going to get, and you have to weigh those two. Sometimes by prohibiting something that's already in play, it creates bigger problems. And I think this is part of the concern of the prohibition. So we already had drinking, and then they outlawed it and try to turn the clock backwards, which you weren't facing when you're dealing with gambling, caused so many more problems that they repealed prohibition. So that's another thing that needs to be taken into consideration. I'm not personally weighing in on whether or not we should be doing that, making dry counties. As you might ask, in restricting this liberty, does it really create does it get you what you want, and that is fewer drunk people and less accidents and stuff like that? I don't know.
Right.
I think many times it doesn't, because you got all the bars right on county line. Mm-hmm. People go out to county. In fact, I've seen lots of bars named county line for that reason. They come out of the dry counties, go across the county line at the county line bar, get drunk, and drive back into the dry county and kill people. So, you know, I'm not sure if that legislation accomplishes its goal.
Okay.
But I think you had another observation here with regards to Prop
Prop 8
in California that had to do with same-sex marriage.
Area.
Okay, because we have a limited amount of time here, but I want to say something about that, because I think this charge is raised, legislating morality, whatever, legislating your religious views and all of this. I think that these charges are absolute nonsense, and I think I can show that very quickly. One thing with regards to legislating your religious views, if a whole battery of arguments can be raised against same-sex marriage that do not trade on religious convictions, but are totally secular, then legislation against same-sex marriage cannot be called religious legislation, period. Because people without any religious conviction can still hold against it for the secular reasons that can be offered against it. And that some people may be motivated by religious conviction doesn't make this automatically a legislation of religion. Because I may be motivated to argue against murder because it's in the Ten Commandments. That's a religious motivation. But that doesn't make that a religious law, because atheists could be against murder for completely secular reasons. So that argument is enough to demonstrate that this is not an illicit legislation of religion. But the question might be saying, well, this is a legislation of morality that's illicit. Now my question is, what morality is being legislated by this law?
Well, and the question, I guess my question is, isn't all legislation sort of form of morality?
Yes,
for everyone?
I think if what we're doing in legislation is trying to use power for the common good, then there is a moral element in every bit of legislation. I absolutely agree with you. But the question I'm asking, though, is which particular morality, which peculiar morality is being legislated here? Now, what they want you to think is that, well, you're legislating morally against homosexuality. And, of course, that's not the case at all.
Right.
Because this has nothing to do with homosexuality. What it says is that the government is only going to affirm and acknowledge heterosexual unions as real marriages, period. Homosexuality doesn't even enter into it. Now, some might say, oh, I know, that's the wording of the law, but we know what's going on in people's minds. And I said, it doesn't matter what's going on in their minds. It matters what the law says. Let me ask you a question. If the United States government were willing to say, which they haven't been willing to do, say, English is the official language of this country, and that's the law, would that be legislating a particular moral point of view?
No.
No, it wouldn't. What they'd be doing is they would be acknowledging what is already the case de facto for all practical purposes, mm-hmm. and affirming it officially. When the government says we're going to recognize only heterosexual marriages, they are merely observing a truth that is a condition of the natural condition of humanity, that families of men and women that are grounded in marriages or long-term committed relationships that are heterosexual are the foundation stones of culture. And same-sex relationships of no kind serve such function. And so what the government is doing with the people's consent is to acknowledging what is the case already, the uniqueness of this relationship, and they are not inveighing morally against anything by simply affirming heterosexual marriage as the standard and the norm. They're not saying anything about polygamy. They're not saying anything about homosexuality. They're not about polyandry, nothing. They're just saying, here's what we are going to affirm, period. So it's not even an example of legislating morality in the sense that it's somehow inveighing against homosexuality as an immoral enterprise. It doesn't do that.
You mentioned some secular arguments against same-sex marriage. Do you have some of those offhand?
I'm going to go to break now. But yes, if you go to our website at str.org and then just do a search on same-sex marriage, you're going to get a number of things that we put together that will help you with that. We've never argued biblically in public against same-sex marriage. They've always been secular arguments.
Sure.
There's also some tapes that I have. When the Bride is a Groom is another piece that you can find on our website, and I talk about those things too. So, Jared, there you go. I got to run right now to break, but thank you
great.
So
Thanks
much.
A lot.
Yeah, and happy Christmas to you too. Greg Kokel, I'll be right back after these messages.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm.
I still think he was flat there. All right, Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show, and I like him. I like the critters. It's probably my ear that is flat, not Bing Crosby. All right, back to the phones, and let's talk to Mike in Columbus, Ohio. Hello, Mike. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Indiana.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I just saw the Columbus, and I made an assumption that wasn't accurate.
Is it Columbus, Ohio?
Okay, good one. Good one. Okay, what's on your mind, Mike?
I wish I would have called a couple weeks ago. Actually, I'd planned on calling a couple weeks ago and then heard the podcast that there was a guy that had called asking about Calvinism and how it relates to, you know, the concept of backsliding.
Yes, That was two, I think, a week or two ago, yeah.
Yeah, there's a guy that I interact with online in an online community, and he has rejected Christianity, but before that, he was a pretty strong Calvinist.
Right.
And so what he says to me now is I should be fortunate that, or I should be thankful that I'm one of the
elect.
And that he's not, and God hasn't enabled him to believe.
Right. Well, he is, he's right. You should be thankful that God's grace has been offered to you when you didn't deserve it. And but he is wrong in suggesting that it's God's fault that he doesn't believe. He's in rebellion to God, and he's going to have to carry that obligation or that guilt himself. You know, just because God doesn't act, you know, this reminds me a little bit of when Jesus was he gave the parable of the man who hired people at different times in the day. And, you know, the guy who came in first in the morning and worked all day got paid the same as the guy who came in the last hour. And the guy who came in early was bugged. And what Jesus said, you know, through the mouth of the boss there, is he said, look, you know, why I gave you what we agreed on. I gave you what you deserved. Why are you angry because I'm gracious to somebody else? That's my own business. And I think there's a message there for this conversation, and that is, if your friend doesn't believe but lives in rebellion, then when he gets what is his due, there's nothing he can complain about. It's God's choice, legitimately, to give grace where he wants to. He's not obliged to give anyone a pardon. And I know he meant that tongue-in-cheek because he doesn't believe any of it.
Right.
But did you have – you had a more particular question about election, right?
Well, I guess the question is, you know, what do you say to someone that says that? The one thing that strikes me about him is he seems – sometimes can get – it seems like he's quite angry at God. And then you know, my thing is – well, if there is no God, he's agnostic. He says he can't know if there is a God or not.
Yeah,
but
I don't know.
I don't understand where the anger comes from. Mm-hmm. If there is no God, what's he angry at?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, yeah. People have said the same thing about Christopher Hitchens. Frank Turek, who debated him a while back, said in the fall, I think, said the best characterization of Christopher Hitchens is there is no God and I hate him. Which seems like a contradiction, but I think that Christopher Hitchens genuinely doesn't believe in God, and he also hates the idea that there could be somebody that would be telling him what to do. And it might be this way with your friend. It might be your friend is just angry because difficulty befell him that he did not think would be consistent with a good God, and therefore walked away from his former convictions. And just denied that God could exist if God would allow that he would experience such difficulty in his life. I don't know about your friend, but I know that's the way it is with some people. And the unfortunate,
I've asked him about that, and he won't say whether there's been something in his past or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, the unfortunate thing is that a lot of times Christians are told falsehoods about reality.
Yeah.
And one of those is that if you're a Christian, God's going to save you and rescue you and from all these things, and everything's going to be fine and dandy. This isn't what the New Testament says. It says, you know, we will have trouble and tribulation and difficulty, and Paul says all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. And he himself, in one of my favorite passages, 2 Corinthians chapter 4 talks about the whole idea of the suffering that he's gone through, many different sorts, some of it, much of it persecution, and talks about how that difficulty turns out to be just, you know, momentary light affliction by comparison to the eternal weight of glory that is being produced by those hardships. This is something we often miss. It is the hardships themselves that are producing the eternal weight of glory, and that's why it's a good thing when God allows the hardships in our life. But if we're sold kind of a sentimentalist version of Christianity by shallow thinking Christians in a kind of a modern, even a postmodern sense, then of course it's going to be a shock when reality hits them and they realize that God does not protect us from the contingencies of living in a fallen world, not all the time. And so it breeds disappointed and often bitter people. And it sounds like that's what your friend is.
So I just tell him, yeah, you're right. God hasn't called, or God has not enabled you to believe.
No, I would say that he is responsible for his own rebellion against God, period. If he's rebelling against God, it's his own fault. It's not God's fault, all right? I think that's the right thing to say to a person like that, because if we say, well, he hasn't enabled you to believe, which I think is true, but all that means is God hasn't given him mercy, which the guy doesn't deserve anyway, nor do you and I, for that matter. But that doesn't mean that it's God's fault he's not saved, any more than it's the fault of a governor who doesn't pardon a criminal that the criminal's in jail.
Right.
The criminal's in jail because he broke the law. He's getting what he deserved. And just because a pardon wasn't offered him doesn't mean that his judgment is not just. And I think that's the message of the gospel, that those who get punished get just what they deserve, and those who get mercy do not get what they deserve. They get better than what they deserve. And sometimes we characterize it, I think, topsy-turvy, that God owes us grace, and if he doesn't give it to us, then it's his fault, not mine. Well, that's not going to wash on Judgment Day. And I think your friend is right, though, as I said, in saying, you ought to be thankful you're the elect. Well,
yeah.
I hope you are, and I am. Because I certainly don't deserve what Jesus gives, nor do you. As nice as you must be, Mike, neither do you.
Yeah.
So, your friend said he's agnostic with regards to God. You might ask him, what kind of evidence would count in God's favor?
Yeah.
Because agnostics say, it sounded like you said, not just that he doesn't know, but you can't know. That's a different
right.
kind of statement. And I don't know why anybody would say they can't know whether God exists. I mean, if we can know atoms exist, it seems to me that we can know God exists. That is, we can infer from the evidence the existence of an unseen thing, like an atom. I think the same thing applies to God, and I think the evidence is abundant. Thank you, Mike, for your call from Columbus, Indiana. And that's it for our show today. That is for our Southern California audience. For the rest of our stations, please stay with us. We'll be taking more calls after the break until the top of the hour, just the way we do every single week. For the rest of you, here's your homework for this week. Go to str.org, and our featured article is Christian pagan? Hear that a lot this time of year. Naughty, naughty, naughty. Don't celebrate Christmas. Well, I examine that in this article. Hope you go there, str.org, and you'll enjoy that. All right, break coming up. More conversation for the rest of you and for Southern California. I'm Greg Kokel for Standard Reason. Go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye, friends, and happy Christmas to you all.